Hello, love. Welcome. Thank you so much for dropping into Time in the Studio today, where we share behind the scenes stories of creatives and plant people and recount tales of change, connection, and plant seeds of possibility. I'm your host, Sarah Marie Miller, and my life is being transformed by plants, art, and these weekly conversations. And I hope these chats can help you along your journey as well. Today's guest reminded me, the more diverse your network, the stronger you are. And our conversation comes from South Africa. I realized that I've never chatted with a guest outside the US. And during Black Botanist Week, I came in contact with Nox Makunga on Instagram. She is a PhD in botany and completed a Fulbright in Minnesota. She currently lives in Stellenbosch in South Africa, and she's done focused work on working with healing plants and indigenous healers and studies how these plants and unique preparations can be deeply healing and beneficial to all people. She shares so many insights about how to study and understand the plants and how the environment of a plant changes its chemistry. She discusses balancing teaching, researching, and writing, and the power of collaborating and sharing the magic of plants with each other. Before we dive in, a huge thanks to QQ for the incredibly kind review on Apple Podcast. They state, excellent questions and superior answers. I felt that Justin's response exhibited forethought and expressed his global interest in a variety of arts and science, highlighting the diversity and exposure people of color radiate when allowed to shine. Anyone who listens will thoroughly enjoy this podcast to start the day or end it. Either will make for a better you. Oh my gosh, so sweet. Thank you so much. This was from A Busy Mind, and I just want to send a huge thank you for that review and just let you know that if you have 2 minutes in the day to write a review on Apple Podcasts, it really helps other people, other creatives and plant people find the podcast and makes just a huge, huge difference, and I'm eternally grateful. So thank you so much for that. And a shout out to a couple timelights this week. Nox Makunga brought to my attention another plant person and podcaster, Tapi Tapi. And this is a friend of hers in South Africa. He's using handcrafted sorbet and ice cream to educate folks about and celebrate African flora, flavors, and food culture. And he has a beautiful podcast and beautiful episode about the folly of a binary life. Please be sure to check that out. That's T-A-P-I, T-A-P-I on Instagram. And really great website there too. Shout out to a previous guest on the show, Heather Saba. You can dig back into the archives and listen to episode 24. She is a clinical herbalist, a nutritionist, gardener, anthropologist, wellness writer, plant protector, and is available by email for consultation, scheduling, and inquiries. Check out her beautiful website at www.heathersaba.com. That's Heather Saba, S-A-B-A. And shout out to my dear teacher, Rachel Weiss. I chatted with her in episode 25. She is an animist and involved in the healing arts, connected deeply to earth and spirit relationships, and is a ritual artist. She works with plants and is living on traditional lands of the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Ute people. Please be sure to check out her wonderful website at www.livingtruenature.com. Again, that's livingtruenature.com. And I love her Instagram too, Living True Nature. Okay, without further ado, let's dive into the show. Cha-cha-cha.
Oh my gosh, I am beyond delighted and thrilled and honored to have on the podcast today Nox Makunga, a PhD living in South Africa. She also did a Fulbright at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and has a deep interest for plants, medicinal knowledge, the preservation of indigenous cultures and knowledge, art, nature, wine, science, chasing sunsets and blue skies. So thank you, Nox, so much for being here today.
It's an absolute pleasure. This is really lovely to connect with you too.
Thank you. So I'm just so curious to know more about your life and your world. And maybe if you want to just give us a little context, like where are you now? How did you get into this beautiful world of studying plants in South Africa?
I come from a really small little town. It's called Alice, and there's a university there, and that's called the University of Fort Hare. What's quite interesting about that university is that it was the first university in South Africa that actually allowed for educating Black, Indigenous, people of color. And this was obviously going on during the apartheid years. And it's also quite famous because Nelson Mandela at some stage actually was at that university. And my father used to work at the university, and I was born in this little town called Alice, and I spent the first 9 years of my life on campus.
Wow.
Before my parents moved outside of that university. But my dad obviously continued to work there, and he basically worked as a botanist. And from there, I studied at the University of Natal, which is on the eastern board of South Africa, to the coastal area. And I then got attracted to move down to the Cape. And now I work at Stellenbosch University, which is about an hour away from Cape Town. And I live in the Wineland.
Oh, fun. That sounds wonderful.
So that's a very short summary of where I've been and what I've been doing and where I work. And I got into plants because partly I was influenced by my father, I think. Mm. Plants have always been part of my world. And my mom is also really into gardening. Mm. And recently she asked me to buy her a whole bunch of bulbs that she couldn't get hold of. So some really fun, unique ones that she wanted. So she's always been into gardening. And I think plants and flowers and nature have always been really part of my life.
Oh, that sounds like an amazing place to grow up in such a rich, beautiful world. Did your father study irises?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
So he worked on the family Iridaceae, or the iris family, and he did a little bit of chemical taxonomy and studied that group, collected some of the irises around the area where we come from, because it's a very nice mountainside. And it's called Hawksback. And some people believe that J.R.R. Tolkien was somehow inspired by Hawksback.
Oh,
like The Hobbit.
Interesting. Wow. That must be an especially beautiful place to be then.
Yes, it is really, really beautiful. And the wonderful hikes that you can take. And it's foresty. So, you know, you can take a really nice hike, and then there's waterfalls. And so it's quite a special place. It's fun.
Wow.
It's a great place to visit.
That sounds amazing. And then, so I saw that you also did a Fulbright in Minneapolis. I was curious what that was like going. Was it a transition straight from South Africa to Minneapolis?
Yeah, I had been to the US before, because when I was doing my PhD, I spent about 5 months at UC Berkeley.
Oh, cool.
And that was really special. And I was quite surprised how much Berkeley actually felt like it feels a little bit like Stellenbosch, and how San Francisco somehow feels like Cape Town. There's lots of things in common, you know, in terms of the weather and just the feel and the vibe of the city. So I had spent some time in the US before, but I hadn't been back for a really long time. And so I was there between 2017 and 2018 in the middle of the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a massive experience for me, coming from South Africa, where you hardly ever see snow unless you go up to the mountains in certain areas. And then to literally be living in the snow every day for about 6 to 7 months.
Yeah.
I learned new terminology about how to dress.
The layers, I imagine.
The layers, for sure, the many layers, and was in blizzards. That was sometimes. I once got stuck in a bus trying to get back to from the university and back to my apartment because, again, there was a blizzard. But, you know, it's a typical Twin Cities, Minnesota kind of thing. So, yeah, it was fun.
That sounds like quite an adventure and amazing. Yeah. What were you studying for your Fulbright?
So for my Fulbright, I was working on a South African plant called Skeletium, and I was interested in the chemistry of this particular species. And at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus, there's a group that's very good with metabolomics, and they basically study all the metabolites within a particular system. And so that's what I was doing there. I babied my little South African plants in a greenhouse. And then after that, I exposed them to different environments of light and even ultraviolet light. And then I was trying to understand how these different environmental conditions actually influence their growth patterns and then the metabolites as well.
Wow.
And this species. Yeah, and this species is quite interesting because it's actually a succulent and it was used for a very long time and still is actually by the Khoi and the San people, who are the indigenous people of South Africa, for divination. It gives you a sense of euphoria, and they would also take it on long hikes and hunts because it facilitates your concentration. So it has neuropsychological and neuropsychiatric activity, and it is being commercialized for depression as an antidepressant.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
That sounds like a fascinating plant.
Yeah, it's quite pretty. I like it. It's got small little yellow white flowers, and then it sort of creeps along but likes to hide under the canopy of other little small shrubs. And it grows in a very dry, arid area, which is called the Karoo. And so it's a semi-desert species that starts to flower in the South African winter once it starts to rain. Because we live in a winter rainfall area here. Yeah.
Wow. How did you know to study that plant? What drew you to it?
Well, the reason I started working on this species is because it has these mesembrine chemicals that have these powerful central nervous system acting capacities. So that I thought was really interesting. I also was interested in it because it has such a long history of use by people. And we live in a world where depression is a huge problem. And so those ideas really connected me to this particular species. And furthermore, in the 90s, there was a paper that looked at its history, as well as its patterns of use by people, and then some chemistry. And that paper for me was a very interesting paper. It's written by Mike Smith. And so that sort of sparked the idea of actually working on this particular species. And the fact that it is being commercialized and will likely become a product that becomes available globally. I was interested in answering some questions with respect to it that haven't been actually looked at before. So this idea of light regulating the compound is something that actually hasn't been studied before.
So the amount of light or the quality of light, the type of light that it receives changes.
Absolutely.
Chemical constituents in some way?
That's absolutely right.
Oh, wow.
So the light intensity, the amount of light it might be getting, the, you know, the time of day it might be getting that ultraviolet light actually changes the chemistry. So you can use the light to actually control the amounts of the compounds and the type of compounds that are actually being expressed. What's also quite interesting is that a study that we've recently done has shown that the seasons regulate the chemistry as well. So at different times of the year, you'll have variable amounts of compounds being produced. And the way we did these studies was to actually look, you know, what happens during the summer solstice, the winter solstice, and we also looked at autumn and spring or fall, and looked at the patterns of the compounds that are actually generated.
Wow.
So it's been quite an interesting study, and these are questions that have never been looked at before, so that's been quite fun to delve into something like that.
Yeah, I wonder about using it for the treatment of depression. I love that it's also just helps stimulate the brain and can be used in divination as well. I'm curious, do you see people using the whole plant, or do you think they'll make like little pills using parts of the plant?
Sure, that's a great question. At the moment, people are actually using the leaf material. Cool. But traditionally, you would actually uproot the plant and chop up the whole thing. So roots, stems, and leaves. Mm-hmm. And then you have to ferment it. So the, you know, indigenous people would actually sweat it inside a leather bag. Mm-hmm. And so then that ferments it. And it also breaks down a compound, which is an acid. And then that sort of increases the amounts of these central nervous system acting compounds and alleviates them. And so it becomes more powerful if you ferment it.
Wow.
So that's the traditional way in which people are doing this. But nowadays, it's used as a supplement. So it's, you know, ground and then packaged into little pills. And as far as I know, they haven't started to isolate compounds and only use one of the compounds as a therapy. So it's still used as a whole extract. You can also make a tea. In South Africa, we like to drink rooibos.
I love rooibos.
Aspalathus. Yeah. And so you have a combination of scillitium and rooibos in some preparations. And so it's often sometimes combined with other teas as well.
Oh, nice. That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that fermenting it makes it more potent. I feel like that is kind of the way that most plants are, like with cabbage or with most vegetables and things. As you ferment them, you know, the vitamin content skyrockets and there's more B vitamins and it just becomes more nutrient rich. And so that's interesting that fermenting the plant helps to make it more potent.
Yeah, it changes the chemistry. And so those chemical reactions then result in a slightly different chemistry, and that's what increases some of the key compounds which are supposed to function on your central nervous system.
And I'm curious, how did you discover that? How did you know? I mean, I read a little bit about you, just that you're able to work with indigenous cultures and travel to rural areas to talk with traditional healers. What has that experience been like, and how did you discover that they were fermenting this plant?
Well, the fermentation of the plant is actually documented, you know, in old literature. The first person who wrote about it, I suppose, is or was a guy called Simon van der Stel, and he was of Dutch descent, and he actually identified the potential of the species already in the 1600s.
Oh wow.
And yes, and the town where I live, Stellenbosch, is actually named after him. He was the governor here. So he recorded it as a potentially important plant, and he wrote this book about plants of the Namaqua land, which were being used by local people and which, you know, grew around that area. And it, you know, things get a bit quiet or got quiet. Obviously, you know, the local indigenous people were using it and carried on using it and still use it. And then it was then, I would say, really in the 70s where these mesembrine alkaloids were being studied again. People were trying to synthesize them and understand their biosynthesis. And then this 1996 paper, I think it's 96, kind of summarized the history and then the chemistry. And in the Cape, you have a group of Khoi and San descendants who have adopted Rastafarianism. And Lisa Philander, who happens to be at the University of Minnesota, actually did her PhD on the emerging medicinal plant culture of this particular group of Rastafarian herbalists.
Oh, cool.
And this was one of the plants that, you know, was mentioned in that particular thesis. But normally I interact quite a lot with local people who are using indigenous plants, well, indigenous medicines, as they hold the greatest knowledge around the plants that actually grow in this area. And this knowledge is obviously very old knowledge. You know, it's been passed on from one generation to another. And African traditional medicine is not necessarily a written traditional system of healing. It's more, you know, documented orally via oral histories. And so it's only really now that South African scientists and even scientists from other places in the world are really starting to collect this information and formalize it. And there's a large drive actually from the South African government to try and utilize the plants that we have here, because they're largely unique. And even this unique set of indigenous knowledge systems as a way to drive the economy. And so there's ideas that perhaps this indigenous knowledge could foster new industries if we innovate around it, and then that in itself could be utilized as a socio-economic input and to uplift communities that might be living in areas where jobs are scarce, etc.
I could see so many pros and cons to that. Like, I could see, like, yes, learn about the indigenous cultures and preserve their wisdom, but I could also see the tendency to want to exploit those things and not allow them to grow. Like, if you cut all those plants down and use them for medicine and then they're gone, like, it's just, I could see how it could be short-sighted. So I'm wondering, like, how to use your experience and your knowledge and hope that it doesn't get used poorly.
Sure. So it's quite important to be able to preserve the knowledge, because it obviously gets lost when you aren't recording it. But at the same time, it's very important to act within the paradigms of sustainability and conservation as well. And one way to do this is to actually start agricultural production. And the herbalists that I work with, who are direct descendants of the Khoi and the San, believe that they would farm in a way that is, you know, in synergy with nature. So they wouldn't, you know, go for a monoculture system and use pesticides and plant these things, you know, these plants in rows, but they'd actually do what they call botanical ranching. Mm-hmm. So you actually grow your crop amongst the rest of the crop. Almost, I suppose, using similar philosophies that are linked to permaculture.
Mm-hmm.
Because they prefer plants that have come from a wild environment. So yeah. They would prefer to grow these plants in sort of a wilder setting. And then you obviously cycle your harvesting regimes. You don't harvest everything at the same time. You harvest and then you replant and you replenish so that nature is always able to give. So that is how they perceive it. And in our environment, we are looking at systems of how to cultivate these plants. And in actual fact, these experiments that I spoke about, where you utilize light and ultraviolet light to increase the chemistry, in some ways enabling, because if you have high amounts in a small amount of tissue, that means that you don't have to harvest a lot of tissue to be able to get the same amount of compound.
Ah.
So that's kind of how we are thinking about it.
Yes.
Using cultivation as a conservation system, but also as a means to provide a livelihood to the very people who hold this indigenous knowledge.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that perspective, and really just looking at the big picture and being able to support the people that hold that knowledge. And yeah, I was worried. I was like, what if, because I feel like with medical companies, or there's just, you know, with big companies, I just can see them like not honoring a system is like, it needs to be, I don't know, holistic
protected.
And yes, yeah. Protected, yes, and like look sure. At the big picture. So
in South Africa, we have what was known as the Biodiversity Act, and this was an act that came into effect in 2004 and 2006, and there are certain chapters of this particular act that actually regulate indigenous knowledge and the biodiversity that South Africa has. And one of the reasons that this act was put into place is to prevent biopiracy.
Mm-hmm.
And so any commercialization or utilization of indigenous knowledge has to benefit the person that actually held that knowledge or holds that knowledge. So there's lots of benefit sharing that actually happen around the natural products industry and medicinal plants of South Africa. So if you commercialize, then you have to put benefits to the communities where the knowledge actually comes from.
That is so beautiful and awesome. Wow.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's a space that's difficult to navigate, because sometimes you don't necessarily have a single person that holds knowledge.
Oh, right.
It might be a community, but then also if it's really ancient knowledge, who do you share the benefits with?
Yeah.
So there's sometimes the argument that, you know, ancient knowledge is actually community knowledge, and so should benefit
everyone,
the community of South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So there is also that argument, but it is quite, you know, it's a regulated system that is supposed to prevent exploitation of local people mm-hmm. for their knowledge.
Wow.
Yeah.
I wish we had laws like that in the US, where
I just feel like everything's just exploited here.
Well, I mean, it doesn't always work the way that you want it to work, because people always find ways of, you know, loopholes in a set of rules.
Yeah.
And some people break the rules.
Yeah.
You know, that's the nature of humans, I suppose. So, but, you know, the laws are there, obviously, to protect Indigenous people.
Yeah, amazing. What has that been like, has to work with the Indigenous people and learn from them? Like, is it, do people want to share the knowledge with you, or does it take like building a relationship with people to be able to really learn about things? Or what is that relationship like?
You need to build a relationship. You know, you can't just go into a community and say, hi, I'm here, I come from Stellenbosch University, I want to learn everything from you right now. You have to, you know, you have to build the knowledge. We're also governed by ethics. You know, there's ethics that govern the interaction with people. So you have to have a permit in order to be able to do this type of work. Mm. And, you know, that, and when people don't want to talk to you, you can't force them to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
They need to also be aware of how that information is going to be used. And if you do end up, you know, economically benefiting from that information, then you have to go back to them and share the benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But the trust building is very important. And the group that I interact with a lot, a group of Cape Bush doctors, and it's a collective, the Rastafarian healers that I spoke to you about, and they collected themselves into a non-profit organization. So it's a formalized organization. And I have a strong relationship with the people who initially started this organization. I see them, you know, on a regular basis, and we've even been on field trips with each other, you know, on a hunt for more knowledge together, I suppose, in other areas. And what was really lovely was one of the healers actually traveled with me to China a few years ago when we went to go and learn about Chinese traditional medicine. And he was, I think that experience was really wonderful for him because, you know, he's an African, and we were in China. So that was really quite interesting how, you know, how different the systems work there and the similarities. And one day he actually said that he had a very strong dream, and you know, and he was dreaming about these ancient Chinese men.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite interesting because he was telling this to me at breakfast just before we went on to conference. And I bring up this idea of dreams because in African culture, people go into healing because they often are dreaming about their ancestors. They will dream about the medicines that they need to use.
Yeah.
They'll dream about the plants and where the plants are and where they need to collect them. And so the sort of spiritual ancestral calling is really an integral of the healing process.
Mm.
And when Cora mentioned that he'd had these very vivid dreams, it was quite interesting. And I think it's particularly interesting because you obviously had lots of interaction of people in ancient times, actually, that were coming from different areas and then coming past Southern Africa. So who knows, maybe Cora has got some Chinese ancestry.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's true. Wow, that would have been such a cool adventure and just an amazing experience to have together. Did you learn, what did you see and experience about Chinese healing or Chinese traditional medicine compared to South African? Were you able to suss out a different feeling?
Mm-hmm. Sure, absolutely. So the one thing about Chinese traditional medicine is that it's, you know, obviously written in ancient script, and there's, you know, formulas of or formulae of the different prescriptions that they, you know, it's much more formalized. So that was a really nice surprise for all of us. In the African context, it's a lot more informal. So that was, you know, a contrast right there. But at the same time, we had a consultation with a Chinese traditional doctor, and it was quite interesting for the African traditional doctor, you know, to swap notes in terms of the way they consult. So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, that would be cool to see just kind of the differences.
The contrast, yeah.
Yeah. And I could see how in Africa, it's more of an oral tradition and experiential rather than like all written and formalized. And so I think it's so important now to be noticing and recording those, that knowledge. So
I think it is.
You're doing that.
I think it's important. Yeah, it is definitely important. And there's a fair amount of activity that's happening around that. And, you know, during Black Botanist Week, we had some conversations actually about even ancient languages that are actually being lost or have already been lost. And just, you know, local names of plants in languages that are no longer spoken. You know, that's a whole new topic, I suppose. And then, because I think language can be very powerful in carrying what plants are used for, where plants might be growing, and just even the ecology around plants. And so, you know, indigenous communities, some of them are not even living in the areas where they would have been living in the past, you know, because of South Africa's history. You know, people got moved around a lot into different areas, new areas. So there's probably lots of information that's been lost in with regards to the plants themselves and then the way in which plants were being used.
Yeah. In your, it reminds me of in your TED talk at the end, I can't remember the quote exactly, but it was talking about when a traditional healer dies, it's like losing an encyclopedia of knowledge.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a quote that is, I think, in every ethnobotanist's mind, you know, because there is lots of information that gets lost. I think the situation quite similar to the US in terms of indigenous peoples of the Americas. You know, they were also moved around to different areas, new areas, and I think their cultures were also broken up by colonization. So there's lots of parallels in terms of South Africa and the United States, actually, with regards to plants, plant use. I was quite surprised to see how, you know, native plants are starting to come back into sort of modern settings in certain areas in the US. I had a really wonderful experience where we had a dinner where a lot of the sort of traditional foods were being made, and that was really interesting to just see that, because I think in South Africa, you're seeing similar things, similar movements in terms of food and culture. You have, you know, people that go out and forage for, you know, hidden plants and hidden experiences, and using the flora that we have in new ways. So that's been quite a large movement. So it was really nice to see elements of that as well when I was in the US.
Oh, so cool. Yeah, I feel like it's coming more into vogue, and I worry a little bit about, again, just exploited resources and using land too much. Like here in Colorado,
there's a plant, Osha, that is really great for the lungs, and it's just this really beautiful, powerful plant, but it only grows very high in the mountains with lots of rain or lots of snow, and it's kind of like it needs a very specific environment. And so people will just go and harvest it all and use it. And I just worry that it won't always be there because people are so excited about foraging and using medicinal plants, but it's like, okay, and there has to be reverence and a balance, yeah, of respecting the plant if you're going to use it. So,
yeah. And the people who are the ones to know about that plant, you need to respect, yeah, both the plant and the people.
Yes.
And, you know, in South Africa as well, we have plants that have got very restricted distributions, mm-hmm, that are only found in certain areas. In actual fact, rooibos happens to be one of them.
Oh, really?
Yes. It only grows in the Cedarburg area, so it's in like in a strip tucked away in the mountain. So yeah.
Wow, that's good to, yeah, know. I imagined rooibos just like grows everywhere because it's such a
no, it's got a very restricted distribution. It's a very strict endemic, and it's found in also, you know, the areas where it's found, quite high up in the mountains, and that climate is, you know, very specific for it. So it's not found everywhere, but some people have started to grow rooibos outside of this area or areas where it's found. So it is quite possible to grow it in other areas.
Oh, good to know. Cool.
Which is good. So if you're going to commercialize something, I think if you start to cultivate it and becoming less reliant on wild populations is probably better.
Yeah. And so we need your experience and your knowledge and your understanding of the plants and your way of just being able to figure out what they need and being able to kind of understand that. So it's really important knowledge that you're working towards.
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Okay. So you're teaching at the university there in South Africa as well?
Yes, I teach several different courses, and they're all plant related and mainly plant biochemistry.
Oh, cool.
So that's my interest.
I can see how you would just be an amazing teacher and just very, you just have this wealth of knowledge and just so grounded and thoughtful of the whole perspective of plants and people and how it all comes together. So that's such a gift that people are able to sit with you and learn with you. So that's amazing that you're teaching and doing work with writing and researching as well. Is that difficult to balance the teaching with the research, or how does that feel for you?
Oh, it can be very difficult to balance teaching and research. I'm quite lucky in the fact that I only teach at certain times of the year. And so from April, I get really busy with lecturing, and then I get busy again in the middle of July, and I am very busy because I teach a basic biology course to the first years, and that carries on right up until August. And then in September, I teach again another group of students, and then that carries on until October. But from January until April, then I have time to spend doing research. And so I really try and focus on that, on the research aspect between January and April. So that's
It's helpful.
It's a nice, it is helpful because some of my colleagues are teaching throughout the year, but just, you know, stopping and starting, and it's intermittent. And so that's harder for me. It's nice to have a block, and then where you're free of the teaching responsibilities, because then I can concentrate on one thing more, and that's helpful.
Yeah, I could see with understanding the plants and their growing season and how they're growing, and then also connecting that with relationships with other people and understanding the connection of people with the plants. That needs a chunk of time. You can't just do a little bit here and there. I feel like that would require very concentrated energy and focus. So it's nice that it's like
that. Yeah, it is quite good. And also it allows us to be able to go and field work, you know, do field work, get out of, you know, the cities and go out into rural areas, which are often really beautiful. And I have a field season coming up now during the holidays and or the vacation. And that's going to be great because then I'll be out in the wild looking for skeletium. And so that's going to be wonderful. It will also take me off looking at screens.
Yeah.
Which is so important, especially this year. I think we've spent way too much time on our screens this year.
So true.
So yes, I'm really looking forward to having some time out.
Oh, that'll be so good. Are there other things that you're looking forward to or dreaming of or goals that you want to work on in the future?
Yes, I have quite a few new projects that I've been thinking about. And so it will be lovely to, you know, start to really get into those.
Yeah.
And so there's several new projects with other people, actually, sort of the international project. So that's quite exciting. It's always lovely to work with other people. I think the more diverse your network, the stronger you really are.
Yes.
So that's going to be interesting to get them going. And I have this project on skeletium that's continuing, but now we are looking at more than just one species. We're actually looking at different species within the same genus.
Oh.
And it's going to be an exciting project. We'll be doing more field work. We will be going into different areas where we've never gone into before. And so that is going to be exciting because we're probably going to meet new people.
Yeah.
And we'll be seeing very variable landscapes. We are planning on going to 3 different provinces, and these different provinces are very different in their, you know, environmental architecture and just in the climate. So that's going to be fun. I like seeing these different parts of South Africa because every 2 hours you drive, it changes.
Wow.
Or even every hour you drive, it can change. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah. This is amazing. And I saw that you've already written about plants and plant wisdom. What was your experience with writing?
Well, I've written a couple of book chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been quite fun. And the crazy thing is that I have a cousin and her name also starts with an N. And she just recently wrote a book about indigenous vegetables.
Oh, cool.
So it can get confusing sometimes because you see my name and then her name as well. And so it could have been her books that you might have seen.
Oh, maybe.
And she's actually a psychologist.
Oh.
But I think this plant thing that runs in our family always pulls people back.
Yeah.
You know, she's a psychologist, a retired psychologist, but now she's been spending time writing about edible vegetables and stuff. So it's indigenous vegetables. So it's quite interesting how that's changing, you know, how her perspective about life is changing. Yeah, but I'm very keen to actually write a book that would be a guidebook that you could use at school level or teaching biology. I've always had this idea that I should write a book that, you know, how do you take some of the science that we do in our labs and you translate it for younger people, and, you know, to teach younger people, you know, how can you do that? So I would be quite keen to try and get into that kind of book writing.
Yeah, that would be so powerful. That sounds very important.
Yeah.
I want to honor your time because I know I'm keeping you up late with the time change, but I want to kind of tune in and see if there's other things you want to be sure to give voice to about your experiences, your reflections, your time with plants and creativity.
Well, I find plants to really be inspiring. I've always had a love for plants. You know, my first words that I ever spoke in English were related to plants.
Oh.
You know? So it's quite interesting. You know, I think my dad just used plant names to kind of teach me English, because my first language is actually isiXhosa, which is a local language. Got lots of click sounds.
Oh, cool.
So, and then I've always drawn plants as well. So if I draw something, it will either be a plant or it will be landscapes and sunsets and those blue skies that we were talking about, because these are the things that really invigorate me. So I do find plants and nature really powerful, and it is something that we as humans are innately connected to. Mm-hmm. And now that we live sometimes in environments where nature is so far away from us, mm-hmm. this I think often causes a disconnect. You know, it makes us more stressed, and stress causes other illnesses that might be physical, and even illnesses that manifest themselves as psychological and psychiatric as well, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think there's real power in trying to create environments that connect you to nature. It's very important. We need this to feed our souls.
Yes. Absolutely.
Great.
Yeah. Well, I just love the work that you're doing, Knox. And it's just
thank you.
Really so wonderful to sit with you and to hear your stories and your reflections and just to hear about your experiences with the plants. And I look forward to continuing to connect with you on Instagram. I love your Instagram feed. And can we just give a voice to, so people can connect with you? What's the best way for people to know what you're up to and connect with you and your work?
So I share my work via Instagram, and you can find me at Knox_Makunga. And I also share my work a lot via Twitter, actually.
Oh, cool.
And yes, and you can find me at KnoxTheLion. And the reason for this is because I happen to be a Leo.
Oh, I love it.
Hence Knox the Lion.
Oh.
And then also, I think this is a fun one. My surname, Makunga, was the name to a character in Madagascar 2.
Mm.
And that was a lion. The lion in Madagascar 2, and I think Alec Baldwin voiced that particular character. So those are the two reasons I go by Knox the Lion on Twitter.
I love that. It's such a beautiful name too, Knox Makunga. It's just has such a flow to it.
It's a nice ring, hey? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, I would love to have you back on the podcast anytime. So
yes, absolutely. I'd love to come back.
Yeah.
It's been really lovely to meet, and thank you so much. I really appreciate the time together. Yes. It feels like a blessing.
Me, I agree. Yes, thank you so much.
Sure.
Oh my gosh, well, have a beautiful evening, Knox. It was just
you too.
Wonderful chat.
Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thank you. You as well.
Okay, then. Nanadi.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please be sure to connect with Knox Makunga on Instagram. That's Knox, N-O-X underscore Makunga, M-A-K-U-N-G-A on Instagram. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful listener and for listening. I appreciate you being here. If you're digging the show, please be sure to share this episode with a friend. And if you're able, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. You can just go to Apple Podcasts, look up Time in the Studio, click on the link and leave a review. Alternately, you can also go to my website that is found at timeinthestudio.com. And there's a link there. If you go to podcast, you can just click on the link there and it'll take you right there to leave a review. Or if you want to have an interest in being on the show, you can send me an email there too. Additionally, you can sign up for my newsletter on that's timeinthestudio.com. Or you can connect with me on Instagram at timeinthestudiopodcast. If you enjoy the show and are in a secure place financially, please consider supporting Black businesses and organizations. I am donating 10% of my Patreon funds to Crafting the Future and will continue to donate 10% to different Black empowerment organizations each month moving forward. And I'd love to connect with you. Let me know what you're up to, what plants you're working with, what you're doing in the studio, what you're feeling, what you want to hear about on the show, who you want to hear from, all of that good stuff. I love connecting with people. It is super fun, and yeah, I want to know more about you. Thanks again for being here, and I hope you enjoy your time. May our efforts benefit all beings.